I realized that I couldn't make a mistake, because every time I made a mistake, it would be like one mistake for me was two or three for another person.
Okay.
They would dock me like crazy. So I just trained hard enough that I just made the minimum amount of mistakes.
Today on the podcast, we have legendary Canadian figure skater Elvis Stoiko, two-time silver medalist in the Olympics, three-time world champion, six times podium finisher at the Worlds. He's also a race car driver. He's an actor. We get to talk about the time he was a stunt double for Robin Williams in Death to Smoochie. We just have an awesome discussion about mindset, his approach to sports, his career, getting outside your ego, and visualization. If you guys enjoy this podcast, share it with some friends, give it a five-star rating. Enjoy. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, no. So with most guys I have on, or lately I've had a bunch of race car drivers on, and I always ask, you know, kind of where did this stuff start? But for you, I want to start with not your motorsports career, your skating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How did you, growing up in the center of the world for hockey, why was it skating?
I get that question a lot, and the big thing is I just wasn't into team sports. I wanted to skate since I was like about 2.5, 3 years old.
Why?
Watching TV.
Okay.
Yeah, watching someone spin, and I was like, I want to do that. And then finally, my parents took me. This is back in the 70s, so we lived in a little town called Queensville, just south of Keswick.
Okay, yeah.
And
up to 404.
Yeah. Before the 404 even extended that far, we had a 50-acre farm. My neighbor raced dirt bikes, and he had a track, and we lived up on top of a hill. And I used to hear the racing all the time, and I'd drive my bicycle down, and I had this great little vantage point up here, and they were racing. I used to watch them. And it was funny enough, Mrs. Watts, Frankie Watts was the kid's name. He was older than me. And my mom didn't know where to take me skating. They finally took me when I was about 4.5 to the local rink in Newmarket. The rink's no longer there. This is a long time ago. And started skating just a little bit during the winters.
But you were bugging them at that age to go skating?
Yeah, it was. But my parents loved skating. My parents came to Canada in the 50s. They came, the immigrants from, my mom from Hungary, my dad from Slovenia, Yugoslavia.
Okay. Yeah.
They escaped the Russian insurgents after the war. So my mom was considered a 56er. They called them 56ers. They immigrated out of that area because a lot of all this communist stuff was coming into play.
Right.
So she escaped, and so did my dad, literally escaped. And one of his friends got shot and killed on his way through Austria. Like,
wow.
Like, really. Like,
so not heavy. Like I was going to say, like, there probably a whole ton of foresight, but was it just kind of at their doorstep?
Yeah, it was there. Yeah, okay. It was like they grew up. I was came much later, so my parents were much older. They were in their 80s now, and so it was a different mindset. So give sort of a layout of how skating came about. My dad was a singer. My mom was a dancer.
Performers.
Yeah, performers. And my mom was the second youngest of 9, my dad the oldest of 10. My mom's side of the family had her brothers were acrobats and circus acts and stuff. So
wow.
Very physical and performing and things like that. And my dad being very physical too, a little guy, a little bit of gymnastics, a little this, a little that. And when they came to Canada in the 50s, they met here. They loved Elvis Presley. That's how I got my name. But they loved the arts and they loved all of that. And they wanted to, like, something for me, they wanted to make sure that if I was going to do something, it was going to be the best at it. So
right.
they supported me no matter what I did, but they actually loved figure skating. So okay. We used to watch it a lot.
Right.
But deep down, I always loved motorsports.
Right. Because of the guy with the dirt bike track.
Yeah, the dirt bike. Yeah. And my brother had a little dirt bike too growing up, but the neighbor raced and I was like, he would see me, he'd bring me down and put me on his bike. And I was just a little guy. And so I just fell in love with it. And back then we didn't have access to like the go-karting that we, you know, even in the 80s and 90s, it was like 80s was very rudimentary.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't have access to that. So skating took the precedent.
So it wasn't out of left field by any means, as far as, you know, your family being performers and gymnasts and stuff like that.
No, I was always physical, always involved in that, but I always loved, I was a loner. I had friends, but I was mostly by myself. So I did some team sports in school for fun, but it was never the thing I wanted to do. I always loved spending time in very calculated mindset on how to do things and very technical and trying to figure things out. That's why I love like motorsports for me, getting in the car and figuring things out and working with an engineer and talking about all the stuff with the car and engine and technique. So for me, skating was like that too, because I'd break down the jumps. I'd break down the whole physics of it all. So I was able to understand it. That's what made me one of the most consistent skaters, because I understood it on a whole other level other than just by feel. As you know, as a driver, you can have people that have natural feel, but they can't recreate it.
Yep.
If you change something in the car, they're like, oh, I lost my feeling. And then they're screwed, right? Yep. Until they understand that, oh, this attaches to this. This is adjusting here.
So you were technical. Like you had a technical understanding of skating.
Yeah, I had a really good sense of that. There are some things I wasn't as natural on. Like I picked up on motorsports really quick. Like whatever I got into, I picked it up really fast. Skating took a little longer, but it was my willpower to like get through it, like to figure it. Like I always say, what was your... Why were you successful? And I always said that I hated losing more than I loved winning.
I say that about myself too. Yeah.
Exactly. It's there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you get, like, again, growing up in the center of the world for hockey, right? Did you take shit at school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. High school was big. I was being pulled out of elementary school all the time. I mean,
practicing?
Yeah, practicing. Because I skated, I was on the ice 5:30 in the morning, and I'd skate before school till 9.
Yeah.
And then do school and then come back again for another few hours. So I was skating like anywhere from 4 to 6 hours a day. And it was just, you know, I did all my homework, changed, and I ate in the car. My mom was just like driving me everywhere. And then I'd hit every single competition. All the little local competitions in the from January, February, March, April, May, all those little competitions could be Uxbridge, Niagara Falls, Sarnia, Thornhill, Keswick. I'd hit all of them. And it just, I was competing so much, performing so much that I got used to being in front of people under pressure.
Yep.
And that was an advantage for me. And my parents, they just knew what it took to be number one, and they really wanted to support me on my dream. And as I was skating, I always have my dirt bike and all the other motorsport stuff, quads, everything was just sort of in line with it, along with the martial arts. That was another thing.
Okay.
And getting picked on in school, that was a thing I got picked on. And it wasn't until I won the junior national title when I was 15. It was on TV.
Okay.
Then I was like the hero in school. Everyone's right. Like, oh, yeah, oh, okay. You're not just doing this as a hobby, Twinkle Toes. I'm I'm not. Like, screw you. Like, this is a real deal. My nickname after that all the time was the new kid, because when I went to high school, I'd come in, I'd do a tutored class before first period, do first period and leave. Then I'd come back for a tutored class after school.
Right, so no one really saw you.
Yeah, they didn't see me. And then during the spring when our competition season was over, my competition season would be from September to March.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd have a bit of a break in the spring and the second term. And then everyone's like, oh, there's a new kid. Now I was back in school all day. And they're just like, that was my nickname. But yeah, I got picked on for it. I mean, hockey was the big thing. Hockey was everything. Yeah. Even today, the hockey is it. But I used to joke around. I'm like, why would I hang out in a room full of smelly guys when I got beautiful women to hang out with?
That's a good rebuttal in high school.
Oh, and
right?
they just look at you and they're like, I'm like, yeah, you're an idiot.
So, like, nowadays, every sport, you know, is like that from whatever, 4 or 5 years old, train. But it wasn't like that for most sports back when you were growing up, but you were kind of, were you the exception in figure skating, or were most of the guys you were competing against kind of the same trajectory?
There was a few that were like phenoms. Like Kurt was a phenom. He started hockey and then switched to figure skating at like 9 or 10.
Okay.
So he was right on the cusp. Any later than that, it would be very difficult.
Yeah.
Because figure skating is like gymnastics. You got to get super, you got to start super young to get used to the inner ear of rotating and leaving the ground and feeling comfortable being off the floor.
Right.
That's a big thing. And then spinning in the air, that takes time to get used to, not getting dizzy.
Yeah.
These are aspects that you got to learn at a young age, because later on when you have fear, you're screwed.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it hurts.
Oh yeah. Hell yeah. And we don't have padding.
Yeah.
There's no padding. We don't wear padding. Like back in the day, these concussions and all sorts of stuff. I got the scars from a backflip. I landed on my face, almost broke my neck. Like
really?
Yeah. It's hard. It's hardcore. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that gives me chills, like hitting my head on the ice without a helmet on.
Yeah.
Oh,
I've done that a bunch of times.
I bet.
And I can't skate with a helmet. Like, I just, with skating, like, even if I'm wearing, like stuff that isn't flexible,
yep.
Right? That's why we wear spandex, because it has to have, it has to be able to be mobile, because with the timing of the jumps, it's so sensitive that anything that's restrictive,
yep.
your timing gets thrown off.
Right.
Yeah.
So being so young, were you pretty good right away? Like, you knew you were good?
It was, when I first started, I just wanted to play.
Yeah.
And then the coach I was working with was a junior national champion previously from the States. And she was working with me in Newmarket, and said, look, there's two boys, all these girls in the club.
Yeah.
He's one of the best skaters, but now he needs to go to a club that actually has better skaters than him.
Sure.
Because you only get good. It's like being on a racetrack.
Yeah.
If you're the fastest guy all the time, you're like, do-do-do.
Yeah.
You only get fast when you're on, like, you're always, I always competed up.
Yep.
So my parents always put me in competitions where, yeah, I could win. No, you're going to the next level then.
Yep.
So I'm always like, so I'm always chasing.
Right.
So around 8 or 9 years old, we decided to go to the Toronto Cricket Skating and Curling Club. Back then, it was like the mecca.
Okay.
They had the best coach, which was Mrs. Ellen Burka. She developed and trained Taller Cranston, who was like a legend back in the 70s. Her daughter was a world champion. And in the 80s, they had like everybody other than Brian Orser and Liz Manley, who were our national idols at the time. All the top national level competitors were there. And I showed up and was like a tiny fish in a giant pond.
Right. But at least you had a barometer, like you had a gauge of how good you were.
Every day I'd watch. I was mediocre about 8 or 9. I had ability.
Yeah.
But what I had was tenacity, the ability to work for long hours and concentrate and just didn't care. Okay, I need this.
And that was, like, you were single-minded? Like, you weren't looking at, I mean, that's still so young. You weren't even in high school then, but you weren't kind of thinking of, you know, further education or anything like that. When did you know you were going to make it?
You like, right around 8 or 9, that's when I went to that club, that was when we were like, okay, this is what we need. We need to sacrifice for this. My dad owned a landscaping company, blue collar, worked all the time. My mom said, okay, we're going to drive you 100%. You're going to do this. If you want to do this, 100%.
Yeah.
And this is what it's going to take. So even back then, when I watched TV, I mean, now you have it so easy on every facet, you can watch anything.
Yeah.
Back then it was very limited. But when like championships came on, I watched our Canadians, but I watched what was the best in the world at my age.
Yep. Yep. You're good.
Cool. So what it did for me was I was able to see, even like later on, like 13, 14, I watched Junior Worlds on TV and I watched guys that were my age competing from Russia that were like, would have kicked my ass. And I was like, I'm behind. Because one day I'm going to meet the guy.
Sure.
Sure enough, the next year I was competing against him and he kicked my ass. But then after that, he never beat me again. But the whole mindset of it was simply that is what it took to be the best. My parents, they knew it and they supported me no matter what. It was more, and it wasn't like they had to push me. They had to, like, my mom would be like, hey, we got to go. One more, mom. So it was constantly like trying to be like, to just, it was, I was relentless. I used to get, the injuries I used to get were always overwork injuries, shin splints and Achilles tendonitis and patella tendonitis, all this stuff that would come out. I had to like back off.
Right.
Cause I'd over push. The good thing is I have good genetics so I could take the pounding more than some of the other guys that were a little bit thinner, a little bit more delicate. Sure. I could take the pounding.
Right. So did you, like, I guess maybe your family did, like, who conceptualized what a career would look like in this? And, like, you know, it's not like you were going to be making Gretzky money if you made it, but was there a defined career path that made sense?
Yeah. So like you asked a question earlier. So my parents and I, we sat down and with Mrs. Burka kind of said, okay, you know, she said, yeah, your son has talent and could make it to the Olympics. So I remember sitting down with my parents. I was around 10 years old. And we knew the next Olympics was Calgary.
Okay.
So we watched Sarajevo in 1984, watched Brian compete. I was a little guy, you know, 10, 11, 12. And that's when I started kind of getting to that real, like started that beginning stage of getting the, into that competitive range.
Yep.
Right. And so, and I was there with the guys. I was better than guys roughly my age, but I still needed to be better because I was comparing myself to some really good skaters internationally.
Full grown men too.
Yeah. So they were, I was comparing myself and be like, oh, I'm behind the eight ball. I need this, this, and this. And my parents said, look, your goal has to be Olympics by the time you're 15.
Wow.
In 88.
Wow.
Like you, so I was like, okay. So I was like, yep. That because if you like even now it's like even in gymnastics they're all super young. It's not like you're gonna do it when you're 22, right? So to get ahead of the ball. So my parents were really pushing and put that in mindset and said this is what we need to do. So no stone was left unturned. The great thing was I still had a balance with my martial arts and my dirt biking, which I did. I didn't race dirt bikes because obviously the danger of it, but. I had a track and I would train. I'd use that as training. So I did what's called true cross training.
Okay.
Where people are like, oh, I'm working out. I'm doing different movements. No, that's just working out. That's like doing a workout.
Yeah.
When you cross train, you're crossing two sports.
Mm.
That like for me, if I golfed, it threw me off because of the swing, because of the way my back, my timing is.
The rotation, yeah.
But the biking worked because I used the adductor muscles and my back and my balance on my feet.
Yep.
I had really good balance. So it was very, so I was working certain muscles in a slightly different way that allowed me another sense of balance. That's why I picked up car racing quickly because of the motocross.
Yeah.
There's like, you got four appendages going all the time on two wheels where you sit in four wheels and you're like, whoa, this is more secure, right?
Yeah, totally.
So for me, the pushing with my parents, that drive, we laid it out and by the time I didn't make Olympics when I was 15, but I won the junior national title at 15.
Okay.
And that was it would have been really a stretch to be 15 at even back then it would have been a real stretch.
Sure.
And Brian was going to Olympics and but I made the next games. I was there. I was 19. I was at in France, in Albertville. I made the team, and was 1988. The next year I was a senior.
Right.
So I didn't make it to nationals, but the year after that in 1990 I made worlds, and that was when my career took off. I hit the world scene. Was my first world championships. I was top 10, and then I went 10, 6, 3, 2, 1, and then 1, 1, 1, and then just. The career grew from there, but all of the building of it was that time between the ages of 8 and 15, 16. That was the real meat of it.
Yeah.
And it was just the sacrifice and the time and the effort to go in and the never give up attitude. There's numbers of time, of course, you feel defeated. I grew 3 inches and lost everything I worked for in the last 10 years. And you have to regain it all. And you go through all of it, but it's the willingness to go and not let go of that goal that you want.
So you're now like fast forward, you're competing within the Olympics. Financially, how does that work? Do you have to go and find endorsements? Does Canada provide enough funding? Like I have no idea.
It's a great question because it was so funny because I just talked with Dave Tennyson about it. And he was asking me, he said, you didn't have sponsors? I'm like, nope. I didn't have sponsors until I won Worlds.
Okay.
I was second in Canada, third in the world, second in the world. I was known. We had the world champion in my home country who I was second behind, Kurt Browning at the time. Didn't have a sponsor. I was out doing work with my dad, landscaping and stuff.
Funding it yourself.
Yeah, my dad was funding the whole thing. You know, I got product once in a while and things like that, but you can't pay the bills with product.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until I actually won. So it's, and people say, oh, you're fine now. And I'm like, dude, I'm not a hockey player. I don't make that kind of money, right? You know, later on, we started making good money when we were touring.
Okay.
But the problem was I was an amateur touring, so we weren't allowed to have money because it would make us ineligible.
Right.
It's different now.
It's different.
Back then you couldn't do it. So I went to a trust fund and that's how they kept us eligible. So I'd only take out what I needed to pay.
Okay. So explain that touring, like you were doing shows.
Yeah.
And it had to go into like escrow or into a trust fund.
Yep. So Skate Canada. Yeah. Wow. So back then it was called CFSA, which was Canadian Figure Skating Association. That trust fund for all the skaters. And then whatever you made, like on the side touring, because you would tour, but you weren't, you know, you couldn't use your sport to make the money.
Right.
So yeah, because then you were professional.
Right.
Which was really weird, but that's how it was back then. Yeah. So it would go to a trust fund and then you could extract what you needed for only for your expenses.
Wow.
But I didn't get those until like 93, 94 when I was already kind of making it.
Yeah.
So we didn't get, it wasn't until then that I actually got sponsors, and I had McDonald's, Canon, Gold Seal Salmon, McCain's, all the McCain commercials.
And how did those come about? Like, those are big.
They, as soon as I won, it was so weird because in 94, that's when everything like exploded for me. I was second in the world the year before, in Canada. It was a little bit of help here and there, but nothing major. And then I go to Canadians and I win. I beat Kurt. I beat the world champion in our home country. Then I go to Olympics and it was a controversy. People said I should have won. I was second.
Okay.
And Kurt was the guy to beat. I was ranked fifth because all these so-called professionals were allowed to come back and compete. So the 88 world Olympic champion came back, Brian Boitano. The 92 Olympic champion, Viktor Petrenko, came back. Kurt Browning was a world champion. So he had 1, 2, 3, 4 guy. I was ranked fifth because I was second in the world. So I was now ranked fifth.
Right.
And I'm like, I like that spot. No problem. I went out and came second.
Yeah.
And almost won. Then between Olympics, because it goes January, February, March. So you got nationals, Olympics, and world. So 7 weeks later, I'm at the world championships and I'm like, I'm winning this. Mm. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
I don't know how. And that's when I did the Kung Fu program, which kind of put skating on its head. And I went out and won on every, back then we didn't have the points, we had ordinals. Every judge in the short program, I was first. And every judge in the long program was first. I like cleaned house. And when I got back from nationals leading to Olympics, my agent was getting trickles of like, yeah, this company's interested. This company's in that were, they wanted to shoot some stuff in between, like, and I was training, like,
yeah.
And then I come back from Olympics and then it just hit the fan.
Right.
I oh my God. And then it started like McCain's was interested. And then we had McDonald's and Canon. And then I won worlds. And then it was like floodgates. Right. I was on the phone like with my agent. Like, what do we do? They want your own tour. I had my own tour in Canada and it just exploded.
So during that, then were you allowed, like, I don't understand, were you allowed to make money off of sponsorship that, like, during that time?
It went to a trust.
Still went to the trust.
Yeah, still went to the trust.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was, the sun was shining and it was time to make hay.
Yeah. So I was trying to do it while I was competing, which is very difficult to do because we train, like, you don't get a summer off. Like,
right.
Like a lot of hockey players, I'm just going to go golf for like 3-4 months.
Yeah.
No. We get like 2 weeks off a year and that's it. You know, and so we're on it through the whole season. So I'd finish competing by March and then I go right on tour, like immediately the week later, I'm on tour traveling through the States or through Europe and stuff. And then I'd come home for a break, put together new programs, do costumes, figure stuff out, the plan for the season for training. And then I'd be touring and doing shows and then coming back and I was training on tour while we're traveling. I'm like trying to find ice to train programs and keep up my technical prowess. Come home, have a little bit of a break for a couple days, go back again. So, and then by midsummer, I'd be back home training full time. And then, because the tours went on for a long time. So all the pro people that were on the tour, they'd keep the tour going.
Right.
So I would jump on and off tour. I'd have a contract with the tour owner because a lot of the amateurs couldn't because they had to get ready for the next season.
Right.
And most of the top guys were on the tour. So we were, we'd be training with each other, like the Russians and the French. We'd like hang out together and we'd challenge each other on practices and then we'd compete against each other. So we'd see each other almost all year round.
Right.
So it made us better.
Yeah.
Like, so to be able to be selected for that tour, you either had to be, if you weren't American, you had to be an American champion or to get on the tour. But if you weren't American, you had to have a world medal.
Okay.
Or of some sort. So I had, you know, I was on the tour for years. It was a tough tour to get on, but it was the one to be on.
Right. Yeah. And that tour, traveling around the States?
Yeah, it went through the States. And then in Canada, I had my own tour later in the year. We did it in September for a couple weeks. We did like small, like 12 cities.
Yep.
We'd go through and do those. And that just showcased me in my home country. And then I would, I would use that as a training for the season as it started in September, October, and then I would just focus on the competition season.
Were you training martial arts during this whole time as well?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people get confused. They think, you know, karate was the main thing. I started karate when I was 10.
Okay. And was this like because you were picked on?
Partially. My dad saw a skater, Christopher Bowman, who did like kickboxing. He was an American guy.
Okay.
Bowman the Showman. He was from California. And he was doing all this crazy stuff. And my dad's like, I think I want to put you in martial arts. It'd be good for your skating and it's good to handle yourself. My dad was old school that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, no problem. So I found a local club in Richmond Hill. So I started doing karate. And then I went through all my belts and became a black belt at 15, 16. But I felt there was something missing with the karate style for skating. There was something missing there. And through my brother, I met a kung fu instructor.
Okay.
He started taking kung fu, but like old school underground Chinatown kung fu.
Okay.
Like really, really cool. You had to know somebody to get in this club.
Wow.
Yeah. So I met Glenn, who ended up becoming like my secret weapon, and he trained me. And within 6 months, I made nationals, came outskated Kurt and made the world team within 6 months of working with him.
Because really?
Everything was circular motion with the kung fu. It's a very different style. And he just extrapolated and pulled out all my like quick twitch muscles. Mm. All the stuff for me, like hand-eye coordination, I have very fast, quick twitch type 2 muscles. So it works great for skating. So he was able to enhance that and fix the timing for my jumps. And then as soon as I got that, I was doing quads like consistently before a lot of guys were doing them because he was able to help me through that. So that was like my secret weapon that I had back then. And the mental side too, the breathing and how to prep and not get like, that's what I use when I race. Like I was racing with Tooth, just doing some testing in Sebring. Never been at the track.
Yeah.
I've done it on the sim. So yeah. I kind of know the track. I'm in a brand new car I've never been in. We're using, you know, radial tires. And I jump in the car and I go out and there's 67 cars on grid. This is PBOC. So we're at Porsche Club. So there's like 15 cup cars.
Yeah.
GT Lambo.
Yeah.
There's like a Praga. There's a Lambo P2. Like, I'm like, oh my God. So I get out there and I'm just like, holy cow. So they were like, Trevor and Trevor were like, they were like, we're all good. Just take a breather. I'm like, I got this. I'm good.
Yep.
So we were talking on the radio and as cars are going by me, I'm learning the track and the car and I'm just watching everybody and everyone was awesome. But it was like when I was out there in the session, like
insane.
Sebring's a big track, but you have 67 cars. So you're always either dicing or being passed or you're passing. So I was just using all my techniques for breathing. It just kicked in and I just did my breathing, calm my nerves down. And I was like, oh, I got this. Boom.
What is the breathing technique exactly?
Well, it's a lot of people, when they get nervous, the breathing itself becomes very high.
Yep.
It gets in the throat or in the chest. So one of the breathing techniques is simply to get it down into the barrel. So it's down below you center it in the chi, just below your center of gravity, basically below your belly button. So it's the breathing technique of holding down there. So as you breathe in, you do a count of, you can do it anywhere from a count of 6 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a count of, I usually do a count of 8. So a count of 8 in, but you also do a count of 8 out.
Okay.
So you're controlling breath. So what that does is once you start controlling that, your heart rate starts to drop.
Totally.
Because as your heart rate goes up and your flight or fight response kicks in, most people start yawning. Mm. And everyone's like, why am I yawning? Am I tired? I'm like, no. Yawning is simply that your body needs oxygen.
Right.
Because your heart's pounding too fast and you're not taking enough oxygen. So the balance isn't there. So what you do is you control the breathing to bring the heart rate down. And then you feel your heart rate. And it's just a concentration on feeling heart rate. And yet pounding harder, yes, because you have adrenaline. But you're breathing, you just concentrate on the breathing. And you just feel the breathing and you get into a cycle of that breathing. There's other exercises too called, we do for, it's called packing. And it's a type of exercise. You're in horse stance and you do a breath and there's two orbitals and there's one orbital that runs this way. It's an energy orbital that runs through the spine.
Okay. Oh, that you're visualizing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But it's an actual thing that runs. Yep. It's all based on like it's very similar to like acupuncture meridians. Sure. Okay. So it runs this way, and then there's another orbital that runs this way.
Okay.
So there's one orbital that we use, and use this one, and it's a specific exercise that we use. It's a technique that you learn in Kung Fu after you've done training, and it's a breathing technique. And that technique helps with combat in the brain for your preparation for something of intensity,
yeah,
where it's going to be pressure. And I used to do the exercise on the planes traveling to like Japan, where you get like tons of jet lag and stuff like that. So I'd go into the bathroom, no one's looking, and I do my breathing exercises,
yeah,
you know, halfway through or three quarters of the way through. And then just, you know, every once in a while, I'm sure before a big race, you know, you're hanging out and all of a sudden you think about the race and then
yeah,
spike, right? Yep. And you're like, oh my God, because the mind doesn't differentiate between reality and imagination.
Sure.
That's why the body kicks in and goes up. You ready? Let's go. Because the body follows the mind. So wherever you place your mind, your body will follow. So it's just a matter of knowing how to control that. And sometimes you can do the reverse, where if your mind is going off, you can go back and control the body, and then it calms the mind. Because the mind goes, oh, I'm okay. I'm okay because my body feels good. Okay, cool. I'm good.
Right.
And then you can, it makes it easier to control the thoughts, because the faster the heart rate goes and you start, your breath starts to get short, the thoughts kick in. And then you're like, ah, and then you can't catch them.
Right.
And then you go down the rabbit hole and then you're like, ah, and then you're fucked.
Yeah.
So you have to, you can use one or the other. You can go mindset, which I use this in acting classes when I'm teaching acting classes as well, is self-talk. Use the self-talk,
yep,
and then visualization, and then the breathing. So it's a combination of all of it.
So Kung Fu opened your eyes to that?
Yeah.
And then you just translated to skating?
Yeah.
Was there, you know, nowadays every sport, visualization, but I feel like it's kind of baked into the cake in skating and Kung Fu. Like, it's necessary to visualize your program.
Yeah, I mean, every night before I go to bed, like leading into the Olympic Games and stuff for like a year, every time I went to bed, I'd picture myself on the podium.
Mm.
I'd see the end result. Then you leave the end result and then you focus on the training that's needed. And the feeling, like if I was trying to get a quad jump and I haven't quite got it yet. I would create what it actually would feel like to do one.
Mm.
So I would just picture myself landing it. And then
first person or third person?
First person.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm literally in my body looking through my own eyes, yep, and feeling the rotation and the torque of it all, and then feeling the effortlessness of doing it. And I do that and then I picture the end result. But it has to be this, the trick with visualization, and this is not a lot of people teach it this way, but the really important part of it, what makes it actually work, is the emotional content involved in it.
Mm.
You have to have the emotion or it doesn't work.
Okay.
Just simply visualizing it is only part of it. You have to create around, and this is this thing about this, then you get into manifestations and things like,
sure,
this is a whole other level, but you need to connect emotionally, because when you race, you're prepping, you're emotionally invested.
Right.
When you win, you're emotionally invested. When you're like training and you're like on point with stuff and you're like, right, you're emotionally invested.
Mm-hmm.
That connection to emotion is what makes it vibrant and real. And that's where life is. If there's no emotion, there's no purpose. There's no purpose, there's no energy. No energy, there's nothing. It's right. Just you're going through the motions. You're an empty shell.
Yep.
So we're emotional beings of vibration. So you control your vibration through the emotion.
Right.
And that is the trick on how to do it. The other part of it is you have to know yourself. You have to know your strengths and weaknesses. I always say, like, you know, the movie The Matrix, when Neo walks in and meets the Oracle for the first time, and she says, you know, I think it says Tenet Nuske on the top. It says, know thyself.
Mm.
You got to know yourself. You got to know these strengths and weaknesses, right? And like in the book of The Art of War, they say, if you don't know you or your enemy, you will lose 100% of your battles. If you know yourself but not the enemy, or vice versa, you only win 50% of the battles.
Right.
The only way you can win is if you know yourself and the enemy.
Right.
Right. So, and those enemies could be your own weaknesses or your own demons. And these, they always come out.
Yep.
under pressure.
Yeah.
And as a driver, you know that. Your mind starts playing tricks on you, right?
So did you have, before Kung Fu or even during, did you have, you know, half-hearted visualizations or half, like where you weren't emotionally there, you know, visualizing yourself, say, on the podium or winning? How did you deal with falling short? Like, hey, I've done all this visualization, but the result didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, because then as you're creating it, you're like, oh, I missed something.
Yeah.
Okay, go back to drawing board.
Right.
So it's just a way for you to take a couple steps back to launch again. It's teaching you something. So you missed something. And it's not always about the winning, right? So you got to realize that it's not always about what it looks like on paper.
Yep.
But you set out your goals for what you want to do, and you try and you lay them out, and you do the best you can to get them. And again, it's a test of wills too, because other people are kind of going through the same thing. So be like, I'm missing something. What is it? But the heart of it is the process. That journey is the reason why you're doing it. It's not the end result. The end result gives you a target.
Sure.
And that emotional connection to that end result is what's going to push you through the weaknesses or the hurdles or the negativity. And then you drive through, and then you, whether you get it or not, at the very, very end, all of this process is the reason why you did it.
Right. Yep.
And then you can take that and take it somewhere else, or you can use it again for another thing. And if you reach the end and you achieve the goal, it's like, awesome.
Right.
It'll spur you on to the next thing, right? I learned more in my failures than I ever did in my winnings.
Sure, yeah. Right? Yeah, for sure. I say every race, like, what did it, where's the lesson here?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the whole point to it, right? We love to get out there and die. That's all of racing, because it's, one, there's no judges.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
I'm sure you do.
Oh, frick, man. It's just me and we're out there racing, and it's the clock, and it's the guy. It's just, it's just in me. I love that. And I've had that since I was a kid. And my parents, they just couldn't wrap their head around, you know, they're like, because they love the arts.
Right.
And I was just like, but I love racing.
It's not subjective racing.
No.
Yeah.
You know, and the clock doesn't lie. Like the stopwatch, you're like, oh, I'm freaking fast. You know, you hear, oh yeah, I'm quick in a car. I'm like, okay, let's
how go fast?
How fast? Let's see it. Yep. Let's see the time, right?
Yeah.
I don't care how smooth you are. You know, some guys can get around the track. How did he do that? He was like sawing at the wheel, but he's, I don't know, he's fast somehow.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
He just has a different style. He knows the car, and yeah.
Absolutely. So did the judging aspect frustrate you in skating?
Yeah, but I always found a way around it. So that's why, that was one of the things that, you know, I had a different style, and it was just frustrating because they wanted me to go a certain way. So I'm just like, no, I'm going to go, this is how I see myself. This is me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to change the style of who I am to fit you and what you see the sport being in male skating.
Right.
So, I realized that I couldn't make a mistake, because every time I made a mistake, it would be like one mistake for me was two or three for another person.
Okay.
They would dock me like crazy. So I just trained hard enough that I just made the minimum amount of mistakes.
And what was the bias?
The bias simply was that I was too macho and I didn't have the same graceful style as some of the other guys. I didn't skate to classical music and have that image that they wanted of figure skating. I was more rock and roll, rough around the edges, kind of bad boy image. But I was just like, it wasn't like I went to do that. It was just, that was my honest self-expression.
Mm.
That was who I am and who I was. And so I just honestly expressed who I was. And that was like, that's why I had to be in vehicles, because that was a way for me to express. Like, to blow off steam at a competition, I'd come home, I'd be pissed off, I'd jump on my bike and go riding. Like, in the summers, I'd just ride my bike, like, as much as I could.
Yeah.
You know, later on, like, when I was living in Mexico, my friend said, hey, man, I heard you want to get into karting and stuff. My friend's daughter races shifter karts. And I'm like, no way. There's a really good track in Guadalajara. And that's where Checo Perez started. Like, he started
okay,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when I first...
Formula One driver.
Yeah, Formula One driver. So, I'm there jumping into a go-kart, ripping around one day, and I'm training, and this guy just whizzes by me, and I'm like, who the hell? And he started, it was Checo, he was training. It was back in like 2012.
So he's a little quicker than you.
Yeah, just a little. I just started. I jumped into shifter cart right away, like the pro stock shifter. And his brother, and a lot of people don't know, Antonio races down there too. He does stock car.
Okay.
He was doing stock car.
Wait, like the NASCAR Euro Series?
Yeah, it was a Mexican series or something going on at the time. I don't know what it is.
Or not Euro Series, Mexican Series.
Yeah, it was at the time. So Antonio was there. So when we'd have our like local races, you know, every once in a while, Checo would show up and race, and everybody wanted a piece of Checo.
Yeah,
no, I can beat Checo Perez. So he'd come out and train with us and stuff. It was really, really cool. But yeah, I just, that was the thing. I'm going off on a tangent, but with the racing, it was just a way for me to blow off steam as well. And that was, again, it goes self-expression.
Right.
It's you know, searching for the perfect lap.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Like, were there specific times, I'm sure, where, like, you felt robbed with the judging?
Yeah, it happens to everybody in certain situations.
Is it pretty good?
No. No, I'll be honest. No, yeah. It was like that. Like, for me, in my world, I had to work for every inch, every mark, every ordinal. I had to claw, and I was never given any quarter at all. Like, they never helped me.
Mm.
You know, if I made one mistake, they'd annihilate me. Where I've seen other skaters, oh, he skated not so bad. Well, we'll pop him his artistic mark up a little bit to kind of balance it out. You know,
right.
there was a lot of like politics and bullshit in the background.
So you really had to have a dominating performance.
So the only thing I could control, because I hated the politics of it, was like, I can control my own skating.
Yeah.
I'll just become invincible and never miss.
Right.
So I just adopted that mindset.
Yeah.
If you're 20% better than the next guy, you can beat politics.
Sure.
That's the magic number, but you got to be 20%. That's why I needed the quad before everyone else did. I just trained it till I was like, yeah, injury after injury and falling until we, you know, and then we ended up doing it. And that's what made it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stupid question. I'm a skier, so I skied slope style and stuff. A quad is 360, 720, 540. What is a quad?
Yeah, we don't use those numbers, so yeah.
But
so
just as far as rotations,
yeah. You got, just put 4 180s together. So it'd be
720.
720.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, 720 in 0.7 of a second.
Yeah, insane.
Yeah,
like, because you don't have much amplitude.
Yeah, my skates were probably about this high off the ice, like the bottom of the blades.
Yeah, three feet?
Yeah, about three feet. Yeah, and some. I was a bigger jumper just because of the explosion rate, so I had quite a bit of distance, you know, anywhere between 10 and 12 feet. It's like spinning like as fast as an electric fan.
Yeah.
Basically, to get four revolutions. Yeah.
So, with the sport not being entirely fair and there being politics and stuff, was there any, because I'm thinking of it from a race car point of view, was there any actual cheating going on?
I mean, what came out in 2002 Olympics?
Completely ignorant to it.
No. Yeah. This is a great question because it's coming from a different sport. Like, we had the big thing that changed our sport in 2005 when we went from the 6-0 perfect mark.
Okay.
Where that's used to be like the ordinal system. You got a 5-2 or 5-3.
Got it.
And then they went to points. They just added up like the way gymnastics is with points.
Okay.
They used to have a 10, like a perfect 10
yep.
in the 60s, and then they got rid of it. In the 70s, they got rid of it and made a point system. Then they did it with us because in 02, there was a big controversy and scandal that happened with our pair team, Jamie and David. Jamie SLA and David Peltier. They basically outskated the Russian team at Olympics in Salt Lake. Ended up second, and then they found out that there was some like behind judging stuff going on between a French judge and the Russian judge, and it got exposed.
And what was it specifically, like bribing or?
Yeah, there was stuff like, we'll support, you know, we don't have a judge on the panel for the ladies event, but we have a medalist, potential medalist.
Mm.
But we have, you know, we're on this panel for the pairs event.
Oh, I see.
Because you have men's, ladies, pairs, and dance. And every country, it's drawn. It's like, you don't technically get your own judge. Like, I've been at competitions where there wasn't a Canadian judge on the panel.
Right.
They get drawn from a hat.
Okay.
And then they're set up.
So there was deals made beforehand.
So all these deals were made if this happens. So this got exposed. I forget all the details. I forget about it now.
Yeah,
you can look it up. There's a whole thing on it. Anyway, they basically gave out 2 gold medals.
Really?
Yeah. So Jamie and David did get the gold. They shared it with the Russians.
And like after the fact?
Yeah, after the fact.
Wow.
It was never in the history of Olympic. No. So what happened was from that point on, it made skating look really bad. And then so all the people that were kind of on the fence with skating went, see, I told you it's fake. And then it just ruined it. And it seemed like it happened once in a while, but it wasn't a mainstay. It wasn't happening all the time.
Mm.
So yeah, like for us, Olympics is like the Stanley Cup.
Right.
But it happens only every 4 years and you may only get two shots at it. If, or maybe even one. I was lucky enough, I did four Olympic games. But yeah, so a lot of crap happens at the Olympics. And it just happened to be that that thing got exposed on this whole other level. And it was just, oh my God, it just, and then eventually they said, we got to put a new system in. And because so many people complained. And then I'm like, this is going to, and skating just went down the toilet.
Put a sour taste in people's mouth.
Well, yeah, I mean, in 94, I went to my first tour with Champions on Ice. And that was the big tour in the States. We did like, there was 90 shows across the States from April till August. And I did about 50 of them because I was on and off. We sold out in St. Petersburg Thunderdome, where the Lightning play. We sold out 27,000 seats, sold out.
Wow.
Then go to the Alamo Dome, was 32,000 people. Okay. So that tour would run. And then there was a competing tour called Stars on Ice, which we have in Canada, the one I'm doing this. They were competing.
Yep.
So they would tour and the other tour would go through and we'd have two casts and they'd tour through the States.
Yeah.
Okay. They also had, I think, 60 shows. They were selling out and doing really well. Now, it was that other than what happened with Nathan Chen, who won Olympics for the States on the last Olympics, before that, you know, since maybe 2012, you have one tour and maybe they will do like 12 cities.
Wow. Wow. So it just fell off.
And venues that, like Kurt and I, for example, we competed in 93 in Hamilton, sold out live television, 18,000 seats.
Wow.
Okay. They just had Nationals in Oshawa, 1,500 seat sold. And nobody knew about it. And not even, and then the commentators don't even have prime time. It's not even live. They're like commentating the taped version. So it just got decimated. It's been ever since they changed the system, it tanked. There's positives to the system, but there's some big negatives to it too. And that from 02 damaged the sport forever. And it's been really hard to get it back. I mean, even too, for me, I'll say skating's not a sport. People snap, but skating's not a sport. It's a highly skilled form of athletic entertainment. And it should be in the Olympics because it's really freaking hard to do.
Right.
But because it's subjective.
Right.
I don't consider it a sport.
Got it.
You know, racing to me, sport. Clock, you, let's go.
Winner, loser.
Winner, yeah.
Yeah, boom. No contest.
No contest. Yeah, there's the odd time. There's obviously shit happens.
Yeah.
But like when it comes down to it, it's like when you sit there and have to wait for a number and they can pull whatever they freaking want, it's like, eh.
Right.
I did my very first kart race in Canada. I remember it was like 2012, and it was a club race at Goodwood.
Yep.
And I was running Rotax Masters.
Yeah.
I just went from shifter to Masters in Mojo tires, which was a huge difference between
big difference. Yeah.
I was like, what the hell are these hockey pucks? And and there was like 26 Masters on the grid. I was like, this is awesome.
Yep.
I didn't know how I was gonna do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never raced in Canada before. I got in this car. I had like maybe 2-3 sessions in it. Throw myself in. I end up fifth. I pass the finish line. And you would have thought I won F1 World Championship. I was so excited because I completed my first race in Canada.
Yep.
And was like, I love this.
Yeah.
I cross the line and I'm fifth. I'm not waiting for a judge. I'm not waiting for marks. Yeah. It was me in the track and the guys racing. And I was so focused. I loved being in that zone. And, and as you know exactly what that is, that zone and things happening and adjusting on the fly. And it was just, I'm alive.
Yeah.
There. And it's been something since I've been a kid. And that's where people ask, like, why motorsports? It's not like I woke up in middle age and had a middle life crisis and be like, I'm going to race cars. Right? Right.
You've been doing it.
Started in the 90s. I started taking my car to the track and I started doing all the preparatory schooling for it.
Yeah.
So that one day when I was ready to actually let it fly, I'd be prepared.
Right. What you said, you're talking about being in the zone. And motors, like a lot of the things I do, it's because I'm addicted to that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
do you have a time that you can pinpoint that was like your peak experience of being in the zone or the flow or out of body or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a number of times when I, in skating, it happened at like...
Big events.
Yeah. You want it to happen at a world championship. Yeah. There was two times it happened in the same, within 2 months of each other. And it was 1990. I was 17. And that was the year that I worked so hard because I didn't make nationals. I missed it by one place. The next day I came from Quebec. I came home. The next day I was on the ice training. Didn't take a day off. I was, I'm making it next year. I don't care. I'm going to make nationals next year.
Yep.
And I trained. In the middle of that summer, I met Glenn. That was the year I met Glenn. So again, manifestation. You set the tone. I meet this guy, start training. We start doing stuff. I get a triple axel. Back then, I was huge at that age. I make nationals. I win divisionals. I win the qualifier. Last year, the year before, I was fifth. I win it handily. Kick ass, take names. Go to nationals. Everyone's like, where's Elvis been? He was the junior champion. Then we didn't see him for a year. And I was kind of quietly competing.
Mm.
Competing well, but not great. So I didn't make a splash, but it all happened in one, like everything came together. Like all these pieces fell together all in one shot. It all came together in Sudbury. So we're there in February and I get there and I'm like having this magical week and it just like, it all came together. Went out in the short program. We had compulsory figures back then. It used to be this thing where you had to like do patterns on the ice.
Okay.
It was very boring. That's why they got rid of it after. That was the last year they did it. It was very boring. It's a basis to all skating, but it was boring for people to watch. So I was seventh, and I was second in the short program. Now I'm fifth. I'm in the last group of men,
okay,
which is a big deal. I'm there with the world champion. Kurt Browning won the year before Worlds. I'm like, wow, I'm on ice with Kurt Browning. Holy crap. I'm like, holy shit, this is like big deal. I go out there, and I go out and skate, and I finish the program.
Yep.
I don't remember it.
Yeah.
And I'm like... It's like driving home and you forgot how you get home.
Yeah.
I'm there and I'm like, holy shit, what just happened? And I couldn't recall.
Wow.
The program. I couldn't recall it. All I know was all, like, I was like, my hair was like, something happened. It was freaking awesome. Like, this was awesome. But
yeah.
Cause you were so, I was in the moment.
Yeah.
And now that's when training and the moment all comes together. Right. And we call it my instructor and I call it a white moment.
Mm.
Because it's like you're floating and it's all high vibration and you're just like, wow.
You feel ecstatic physically.
Yeah, you're just this euphoria.
Yeah.
That it didn't matter what marks I got or what place. I was like, oh my God, something just happened that was awesome. And everyone in the rink felt it. They were like freaking out. Like it was so cool.
Yeah.
And then I go to Worlds and the same thing happened. It was in Halifax. We had the World Championships in our home country. It was really exciting. And the same thing, it just erupted. And I was just like, I got off and was like, I can't recall what just happened, right? And then you're out there and you have those ones where you're like, you're out there and it's a nightmare. And
yeah.
And everything's in slow motion. You're like, I'm going down. Boom. And you're like, oh my God. And you're like missing jumps and things. And you're just not in it. It's just, you're off. But there's a number of times where that's happened. And when I did the first quad triple in Hamilton against the top six guys in the world, super pressure packed, it was another like white moment. It was like so amazing. The only thing is I never quite had it at Olympics. I had great moments at Olympics. Like 92 was awesome. It was like, it was almost that white moment. I skated so well and I half remembered it. I remembered parts of it. So I was in and out of it. It still was great. I was just in and out of it. And then there was 94 Worlds. I was in and out of it. I skated great, but it was that's where that it's weird. It's like you can, the perfection of just complete float, letting go.
Mm-hmm.
You completely let go.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, this was crazy. It just came out of me. You're the experiencer. You're not the person doing it. It happens through you.
Yeah.
It's like someone else did it and I was along for the ride and you're like, this is cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you're observing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so awesome. And I love that, especially like even, you know, training in the car and getting the feel of a little further and just all of that, those nuances suspension and the tire and the, and then you got, and then you got to deal with the guys. But you have like, you have your track training, you're just solo, quali and stuff. But then, you know, with everybody else too, you're just, you, you're aware of everything, but aware of nothing.
Mm-hmm. You're not, you're not, you're not doing it consciously.
Yeah.
It's being done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Such yeah. a great, it's such an, and that's what we all search for.
Yeah.
Because it's, and you want it to happen at like the biggest event ever.
Right.
Right. But the problem with that is when you try to do that, the ego gets involved and mm-hmm. it screws it up.
Yeah, you can't force it.
No, it doesn't. That's why you can't just, you can't just shoehorn it in there and make it happen. You have to allow it to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had that a couple times, and it took me by surprise, that euphoria, like how good I felt.
Yeah.
It was insane.
It's an endorphin rush that you just like, oh my gosh, this is like, and that is the process. That's like it, like allowing the process. So you're there's an amazing book and there's a movie too called The Peaceful Warrior.
Okay.
If you ever get a chance, go. Nick Nolte's in it. He plays the guru in the movie. But the book is awesome too. It's about a gymnast.
Okay.
And he's like a university level gymnast. It's an amazing story, true story. And he talks about this process that he had gone through to figure out this, like, you know. And I have these conversations with Dave Tennyson, who worked with me quite a bit, and we were talking about this. And I put that movie on to him. He goes, "That's the greatest thing. This is what I'm talking about."
Yeah.
Because that's what he was trying to help Nikki with, and Latifi,
yeah.
And a number of his, like, he's working with Saber Cook and a number of other drivers, and it's like, it's surreal, and it's like, you know, it was like the movie The Art of Driving in the Rain,
Racing in the Rain. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's just sort of, you know, and the way Ayrton Senna talked about racing, it was just spiritual.
Yeah.
Right, and you get to that point where your skill level allows you to access certain parts of your psyche that is, you can't get it anywhere else until you do the, but you have to do the training.
Yeah, you have to become a master at the technique or the process or whatever is going to give you that feeling. Do you meditate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. My choreographer, Uschi Kessler, she worked with Brian Orser, myself, and a number of other skaters, and we used to call it effortless effort.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Yeah, because you put effort in, but it's effortless, and you're like, wait a minute, I'm breathing harder, but it was easy. Mm-hmm. Like, this is such an oxymoron. Like, it's weird,
mm-hmm.
and it's such a cool place to be.
Yeah, it's like operating outside of your ego.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you're not worried about the outcome.
Yeah.
It's like Bruce Lee always said. It was such an amazing quote, if I can get it right. The greatest hindrance to all physical action is a consciousness of the self.
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
Huh. So more to the physicality of skating, did you have to, like, just watching some of these routines, did you have to actively work hard on flexibility and stretching?
Great question, because I wasn't super statically flexible.
Right.
I was dynamically flexible.
Got it.
So I could, you know, kick high and then come back, because I had this quick twitch muscle. When I started doing lots of stretches to get the ballet stretch and the line and all this stuff, I started losing my timing.
Right. Because you're changing your physiologically.
Yeah. So what was happening, which I discovered, and they're discovering now, this is stuff I did when I was younger, but I would stretch, 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 stretch. So it's like taking an elastic band
mm-hmm.
and then hold it here for like a day.
Yeah, you hurt the elastic band.
Exactly. The muscles were the same for my muscles anyways, for type 2.
Yep.
Type 1 muscles are long distance, long endurance muscles. So they'll just be great. They'll just keep going.
Right.
But they're really slow. They go out and then come back.
Right.
But the type 2, you got to be really careful with, and you can't mess with them too much.
Right. I've heard this. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and they, now they're, it's all, oh, it's all science. You know, it's so funny with science. They always say they're wrong, and then, no, now we've got it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I'm sure. 100 years from now, we'll look back and say they had it then.
Yeah exactly. Yeah. So I didn't stretch much. So what I would do was I'd limber.
Okay.
So I would end up, instead of taking elastic band and holding it like that, it would be just, oh, I'll just put it over a heater.
Okay.
And then just do this with the elastic band. So you don't want to do this with your muscles right away,
because
you're going to tear them. Oh, stretch. No. you just slowly do movements that are in this range, and then you feel it. Oh, I can go range. And then you go to right to the end of where the stretch goes, but you don't want to go past it, just enough where it wants to snap back, and you know that spot, and you just work that range. Now, there was times where I did stretch out when there's things got really cramped, where our muscles don't act like an elastic. They actually, they come in, and then there's like either not damaged but overworked. I'd have to work on them, and but I would never stretch before I worked out ever. I'd only limber to allow my muscles to go to the range I needed and then come back. So it's the return was actually faster than the launch out. It's like when I was firing punches, instead of the firing out focus, I'd focus on the return. Because then you get it, you get the timing, the return, the quickness is there. It's just a different way of looking at it. So understanding that concept, I was able to listen to my body. Then I started working with this amazing osteopath the last, like, I think it's last 8 years.
Yeah, they're great.
Amazing. He's a guru too. He's an energy worker. I keep hitting this thing. He's an energy worker too. So he's philosophical. This Polish guy, big hands. I call him banana hands. He can put me in a pretzel. And he'd be like, you know, and I started stretching a little bit more just to try to adjust a few things. And he goes, Elvis, don't. He goes, you're going to injure yourself. And I go, I was always right from the beginning. He says, yeah, listen to your instincts. He says, you got good instincts on your body. He says, they're figuring it out now that if there's some people that just have open hips, some people that have this certain flexibility, and there's other ones, he says, you're gifted. You have type 2 muscles. They're really freaking fast. Yes, they're tight. We're going to work on, you know, sometimes get pulled out of place and your alignment has to be adjusted. But we'll get you there. But he doesn't do it in a way where the muscles want to, like, punch him in the face. Like, it's got
back or,
you gotta do it where the muscles allow you to be manipulated. And it just, as long as the muscles are, sometimes they, as they run along the skeletal system and even the fascia, it gets crisscrossed. So what he does is he just aligns it all. So that then now you can get the full length. They're not crisscrossed. So they're now running perfectly, and allows them to function properly and efficiently. And that's what he does with me. And I honestly contribute the, knock on wood, the lack of injury from understanding my body in the overstretching category. And knowing your strengths and your weaknesses. So one of my weaknesses is not the static flexibility. My strength is my type 2 muscles, which again applies to racing like crazy. So the quick twitch is hand-eye coordination is there. So it's just a matter of learning the skill set needed when racing.
Because that was probably unorthodox at the time to not be stretching. Like, that was kind of peak, you know, stretch before you lift, stretch before you run, stretch before all this stuff.
Well, it's crazy because what happened was, I would, they'd say, oh, you stretch. I'd go out there, I'd stretch, I'd go on the ice. And yeah, the static movements, like there's like a camel spin or a spiral where I hold my leg up parallel to the ice. And yeah, those were easy. Then I'd go to jump and I'd be like, ugh. I'd have no spring. I'd be like flat, no muscle explosion. I'd be flat. I'm like, what the hell? And I'd be like, oh. I stretched a lot, and I was listening. This is, oh, this is the typical thing, and this is like trainers that are trainers, but they're not skaters.
Yeah,
right. And this is like in the 80s, early 90s, mid 90s. This is like, this is not working. So I purposely didn't stretch. I go on the ice and warm myself up, and I was like 12, 13, 14. It was like I knew instinctually. I was stubborn. It was a bit of a pain in the ass that way, but I would always test. I'd go out there and I'd skate like a demon. I'd hit everything, and I'm like, "Fucking, I ain't stretching again."
Yeah.
I would. I'd kind of limber up, and I'd kind of like kick, feel. Oh, yeah, I'm stretching. And okay, I'm gonna go skate, and I'd go out there and I'd do everything, you know. So it just took me a while to kind of figure it out.
Are you into kind of the current health? Well, maybe it's not current. It's probably old wisdom, but like sauna and cold and stuff like that for health stuff.
Another great question. I don't do the cold baths.
Okay.
Nope. And here's my reasoning. So I used to have a lady that went with me to all my competitions, most of my big ones anyway. She was an acupuncturist, traditional Chinese medicine. So traditional acupuncture.
Yep.
Hungarian family, believe it or not Chinese, but she learned from the Chinese system. And her dad worked on me since I was 4 years old. So the daughter, Susan, she's passed away now, unfortunately, but went with my mom and I and coaches, and she went to Olympics and Worlds, and she was my healer. We had our national team doctors and stuff that were there, but she was my acupuncturist. And the philosophies behind it, she'd always say, you know, if I had an injury or something happened, she goes, Elvis, never ice. Use heat. When you first injure it, yeah, you can put ice on it, but try to do minimum ice. And I followed that philosophy. And so I asked her, I'm like, why? She goes, arthritis. She says, your body is not meant to take that much cold, like that type of cold. Arthritis will get developed in your joints. Trust me. This is a Chinese philosophy.
Wow. Okay. So heat only.
Heat only. So yeah, obviously when you first injure, you don't put heat on, it's going to expand.
Sure.
So you it's acute.
Yep.
It's very quick. Cold. Once it's done within that day, you're done. It's heat. Right? Or slowly stretch and then use the needles to help with that. When I try cold baths and I'm like, ice baths. I was like, this is stupid. My body's like, screw you, man.
Yeah.
Like instinctually, I listen to my instincts.
Yep.
And I was like, no. And I don't follow fads.
Yeah.
Like there's so much crap. Like
I'm sure you've seen a lot of it.
I've seen everything. Okay. And I'm just like, I broke the internet seeing stuff. And I'm just like, it just depends on the person.
Yeah.
Because they'll say, look, well, this work. I'm like, that's why there's like so many different diets and then so many different like ways of training. And there's so many. And I'm like, oh, this is the one. This is the one for you. I'm like, that's such bull crap. Yeah. And they're talking to you like all of these millions of people. I'm like, everyone's different.
Yeah.
Like that's why, again, it goes back to Neo. Know yourself. Mm-hmm. It leads into things like this.
Yeah.
You have to know your physiology. You have to know, like, I know what my blood type is. I know what types of food are good for me. I don't eat chicken because it's got uric acid in the breast. So when I eat it, because my muscles are very high, quick twitch muscles, I create more lactic acid than the average person.
Hmm.
So if I have dairy or chicken, I'm at a 50% deficit before I start training.
Wow. So what do you eat?
I eat gamey foods. I was just in Newfoundland.
Wait, do you hunt?
No.
Okay.
I don't know how to like clean and do all that stuff, but we did have a farm. My dad did all the killing. My mom did all the cleaning of the chickens back then when I didn't understand, but
we
had our own cows and pigs and I ate everything.
Yeah.
Now I don't eat chicken because I understood that and turkey's fine, but there's certain foods, dairy I don't eat either because of the cause it's acidic, and it's lactic acid. So I eat like gamey stuff. Like we were like in Newfoundland, they found out I love moose and the people there, they made me like this beautiful moose stew.
My body's
like, went. You know what I eat in the morning?
What's that?
Oysters.
Oysters?
Raw.
Okay.
I shuck them myself.
How many?
Anywhere from 5 to 15, depends on what my body needs.
Yeah.
The question is, why do you eat oysters? Zinc.
Okay.
Number one, muscles, firing. The firing mechanism, zinc is used in the muscle to fire. The ATP process, so quick twitch, to allow the nervous system to work, all that stuff, zinc. Men are low in zinc, women are low in iron.
Iron, yeah.
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 It's also good for the junk.
Yeah.
Zinc's very good, keeps you healthy. So that's one aspect in understanding what your body needs, what your physiology needs. So all this stuff that happens online, it's like, take it with a grain of salt. Take the information, because there's a lot of good information too.
Sure.
Look at it and go, what can I use?
Yeah.
What's going to be good for me? And you gotta trust your instincts. Don't follow just one way of thinking. There's like so many different people I've worked with, and I've taken all the little pieces and made my own salad with it to understand. And that's one of the, because people ask me, like, how are you still doing it at 51 years old? And I'm doing stuff younger guys are doing. I'm like, because I've been really smart about, and I've been very lucky because my parents were like that.
Mm.
We had our organic farm back in the 70s, which was like unheard of.
Right.
And my mom always knew this. She just had this incredible instinct and intuition. Woman's intuition was on how to eat and what to avoid and listen to your body and instinct, and it's been amazing. And to this day, I'm, you know, doing my thing and healthy.
Yeah, if you're in tune enough with your body, it becomes pretty obvious. you know, you eat something, you feel like shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Move on.
Exactly. And, yeah. and it just, it's just like so many people like, you know, vegan is the way to go or vegetarian is the way to go. I tried to do it for like a summer and I was like, I did the, not even vegan. I just did vegetarian and I was yellow. Like I just was awful.
Yeah.
Then I was dying from, I have to have meat. And, as soon as I got the back to the meat, my I could feel it, just like, you know, Popeye and his spinach. Just my power came back, and I'm like, oh yeah, I need this.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I'm a hunter, so we got four deer this year, so I've got freezer full of deer and goose and turkey.
I'm calling you up for deer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
dude, I want some deer.
Yeah, venison. I need to get a moose though. That's how you really fill the freezer.
Oh yeah, the moose is. Oh my god, in Newfoundland, I mean, it's like a lot of people don't know, but it's the largest moose population on the planet. It's in Newfoundland, and they have no deer there. It's like you land in Deer Lake, and you're like, wait a minute, there's no deer on the island. It's so weird, but
it's insane.
But the moose there, oh, they and I have moose jerky. They gave me moose.
Nice.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah.
Was it? Like, you're a competitive guy, and, like, when I was a kid, losing was really hard, and you opened this with, you know, you hate losing more than you like winning.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you come to terms with losing?
You have to be a good loser before you become a good winner.
Yeah.
You know? And it was I think it was just the way my mental set was, like, yeah, sometimes I'd get down on the losing part. I'd get mad. It might be the Aries in me. I'd get hot-headed right away. And then be like, no.
Yeah.
What do I need to learn here? So my brain would automatically go, next competition.
Mm. So that's how you deal with it.
Yeah, so instead of sitting and festering in what you just did, I'd already be, okay, what do I need to win the next? Like, my brain would go, screw it. I don't like staying here. Mm-hmm. I hate this feeling. I hate this negative vibration, whatever it is. And my brain would go, okay, the next competition, I'm not making the same mistake. No freaking way. And then I would just, it would inspire me not to make the same thing, make it twice. It's like, you know, you make a mistake once, then you're twice, and the three times you're a bit of an idiot if you keep making the same mistake. So it's just, it was just the way I looked at it. Always look at the silver lining. Mm. There's something hidden. Mm-hmm. I missed something. What did I miss?
Yeah.
Right. And then you change the way you think, and then you're like, okay, now I'm on the hunt. Then you're on a positive cycle.
Yeah.
Then you feel like you're moving forward instead of retreating back internally to a point where you start eating yourself. Your confidence goes down, and you know. And again, it was an instinctual thing, and a lot of it had to do with the martial arts training.
Mm.
And it started. It really helped me right around the age of 16 when I was working with Glenn, and there's a really cool aha moment that I had, and I love those moments when I'm working with students on, you know, hockey or skating or with the acting. So he used to come to watch me at the rink, watch me interact with my skating coach. And there's one day I was working on the triple axel, and I was like, my timing was off. I just couldn't get it. It wasn't working that day. And I did like 1 out of 10. I tried 10 of them. I got like 1, and it was kind of wasn't even great. And I was like, fine. So I finished the session and came off, and I'm up in the stands, and Glenn goes, dude, where's your mindset with this? Like, what are you thinking? I said, I'm trying not to, like, I keep doing this, and I can't, like, not, my body keeps wanting to do this, and it's ruining this, and da 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 da. And he goes, okay. He said, let's start over. You landed one, right? Yes, yeah. The feeling was pretty good. And I said, yeah, it was pretty good. He goes, okay, how were they yesterday? I said, really good. It was on. He goes, okay, pick the best one. I went, okay. Go back and close your eyes and visualize that one. Automatically, I'm like, felt good. Like, I can feel it. He goes, okay, don't focus on the negative ones. Instead of trying to block the ones that you don't want, strive for the one you do want. And then I had the aha moment. I looked at him, he goes, there it is.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man. So I was like, I had to aim to replicate the good one. So as soon as it did that, I felt my whole body. And I'm like, dude, why am I like, like my whole body feels jacked right now. He goes, good, you just changed your energy.
Mm.
This was back in like the late 80s, early 90s. This is all like kung fu stuff.
Yeah.
And he goes, next session I went out, nailed it.
Mm.
Because I was able to change the way I perceived it. So if I made a mistake in a competition, I'd be like, ah, man. I'd go back and try to remember the competitions I did well, compare and figure out why I did it well, not why I didn't do it well.
Right.
Right? So you're always on the defensive rather than the offensive.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Right? So it's a and again, self-talk, yeah. Where you place your mind, body follows the mind.
Yeah.
Change the cell feel. Now you're accessing what you want to access. Now you're moving forward. Now you're all going like this towards the right direction. Get out of your own way.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it's done.
Mm-hmm. Was it Glenn, or I'm sure it was a little bit, but who introduced you to this? You've got this spiritual kind of undertone to everything, or you know, energy or whatever. What can you articulate that a little bit? What that is?
Yeah, that started coming a little bit, like right around that age too, right, 15, 16, 17, around 17 years old, I started sensing things beyond my body, where you're getting to that age where, you know, when you turn 18, like there's an age where you're like, you feel invincible, you go to compete and you do stuff and it's yep. easy. And yep. you didn't care about the, you just do it. You didn't think about the outcome. Then you hit a run around 18, 19, and this is where my specialty is, where I'm working with kids in that crossover. I have parents come to me and said, my kid used to be awesome, and now he's like freaked out when he competes and he doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah, right? Doesn't want to lose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or he's afraid of making the mistake, and I'm like, yeah, it's called growing up.
Yeah.
It's called becoming an adult. And you start to realize the consequences of your actions and how they affect the world around you because now you start seeing yourself a different way.
Mm-hmm.
The ego is being built.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, it's the first time it rears its ugly head, basically, because it's being built from the age of 2.
Yeah.
The formative years between 2 and 7. And then from there, again, there's another level between 7 and 16. So what happens is it ends up becoming a point where this starts taking over.
Mm-hmm.
So it was basically... lost my train of thought because there's so much involved because it's not a simple way of looking at it, but I'm trying to make it simple.
I guess who are some of the influences?
Yeah, so with that, the martial arts, sort of like, lack of a better term, the mystical part of it, the martial arts allows you to understand energy and energy flow in your body. And vibration, and it's not just simply, oh, positive thinking. I mean, that's very cliche, but you start to feel energy, your chi energy, which is your life force. And now you can feel, and that I understood a lot, and I have a feeling it had a lot to do with working with Susan with acupuncture needles, because I would feel the needles go in. Because the whole premise behind is you have an injury, there's the meridian is blocked. So you put a needle in there, and that particular point, and it allows, it frees up the energy. So now your body can heal itself. So you get a flow. So wherever there's a blockage, then I could feel it. And I would feel the needles. And I've had it since I was 4 years old. I had it my whole life. So that was a huge part of it. And then the whole culture of the Chinese way with the energy flow with that, it all sort of rolled into one. And I just applied it to everything. So it started a lot with the acupuncture, but the kung fu is really the basis of it. And I remember 17 going to that competition in Sudbury I told you about, the nationals. It was,
yep.
And I remember everyone took the bus to the rink to get to the rink, and the rink was like 18 minute walk. And I was like, I'm gonna walk to the rink. And my coach is like, are you sure you're not gonna get tired? I'm like, no, I need this time to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, we'll see you there. So I left early, and it was surreal. I knew I was going to make the world team. I knew something was going to happen. And my mind started visualizing the competition, and I stopped it. Because I knew if I played it out in my head, I would have played it out. I had to allow it to happen.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to see it because I needed it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that was trusting. And it was this instinct I had. And I remember that moment. That was like the very first like real, like it was very spiritual because it went beyond the winning. But I just knew something special was going to happen that night. Just didn't know what it was. I just was and I just needed time to myself. I had my Walkman on and I was just listening to music. And I just knew instinctually not to look. I was, because if you see it before it happens, like that type of thing where it comes to you, not where you're not when you're going to bed and visualizing and creating. Yeah. It's actually coming to you.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to see this yet.
Mm.
I'm supposed to experience it in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the very first times that spiritual side of me started coming out. That's when I was like, wow, this is a whole other world. It's not just going out there and doing a few jumps and winning.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, whoa. So to me, I still remember like yesterday. I still remember the walk to the rink. And I still remember the moment like it was yesterday. And that was the first time, that inkling of it. And I've had moments. I've been on touring hotel after hotel, and you forget where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then one morning, I'm like floating above my body. And I was like, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
Absolutely exhausted. And I'm floating above I'm looking at myself. I'm like, oh my God, I'm out of my body. Floating around the room. And then I look back at the clock and I see the clock and time kicks into my head and boom, I went back in my body. And I look over at my roommates. He's out. He's out. We had a day off that day. And I'm just like, that was wild. Tried to do it again. It has to, you have to allow it to happen. So I've had these bizarre moments. Yeah, just wild.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people who seek those type of experiences, they come so much easier when you're able to inhabit your body. And like your whole career has been that, like through Kung Fu or through skating and even racing. Like you can't contemplate your way to those experiences. It has to be more, you know, in your gut or visceral or in your body, being like your consciousness inhabiting your body.
Well, here's the thing, you'll understand this because you've trained so much in, and you do other sports as well.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you start? When did you start racing or getting
seven?
Seven. Okay, doing this a long time.
Yeah.
So you're proficient at it. You're doing all these things. Now you look back on it. Would you say that you had to add to your body, to yourself? You had to add the skill set that you needed? Or did you take away things that were holding you back to reveal what was already there?
Yeah, it was probably the latter. Yeah, it was probably taken away, getting out of your own way.
Exactly. So what that is like a carver carving a table.
Mm.
He saw this table in the wood already. He just removed
mm-hmm.
what was the unessentials.
Mm-hmm. But the tool is the experience. The tool that's taking away is the, you know, each individual race or each individual practice day or whatever.
Removing the unessentials, removing the fear, the inhibitions, the things that block you, the what will people think, I'm afraid of success, I'm afraid of failure, blah, blah, all that stuff. The guilt of winning because a sibling or whoever, you're like, oh my gosh, I mean, I'm winning and this person, like, or I'm not winning enough. And like, there's all these ego external things that get in the way. And then you eventually just remove all the stuff and you just are who you are.
Mm-hmm. It's very Zen, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Effortless effort.
Yeah.
It goes right back to that simplicity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're a performer through and through, I would say anyways. And now, when did you start acting?
I started acting when I was like 10.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So there was a school I went to between grade 5 and 8, and it was like a little house in the prairie. It had like kindergarten to grade 8. There's only 32 kids. It was a husband and wife team. They were the teachers, and it was a private school. It was great because I could leave and come back and do skating. The husband, he wrote music. He was a musician. He played piano, and he wrote like plays. So every year we did plays, And everyone was in it from kindergarten to grade eight. All good?
Yeah.
Cool. From kindergarten to grade eight. So everyone was part of this, like, play that we did at the end of the year. We got the script, and we had to sing on stage and all this. So I was in, like, year after year, I started, like, doing plays on stage and learning lines and all this stuff. And I was already a skater, so I was not afraid of being in front of people.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing a lot of the club shows. As a, they used to invite me when I was 9, 10, 11, 12 as a local skater. He'd come out and perform. And later on, I started doing, like, little cameo roles. I was like cameo. I'd be like a hockey player here and a little, like little clips and stuff. And I always loved acting. And then in 2001, Danny DeVito contacted my agent.
Okay.
And said, we want Elvis to choreograph a skating number at the end of our movie called Death to Smoochie.
Right.
Little did I know that I was working with Robin Williams.
Wow.
He was playing Rainbow Randolph, and Smoochie was Edward Norton.
Okay.
So I'm like, oh my God, this is like wild. So they, at the end of the movie, there are two characters. They're kids show characters. One is the Rainbow Randolph, and the other one is a dinosaur, purple dinosaur, right? Like Barney.
Yep.
And that was Edward Norton's character. And they were like, it was a dark comedy. They were like fighting against each other.
Mm.
Like who's going to be more loved by the kids and their show. Right. It's like really bizarre. But anyways, happy ending. And there was a big skating thing at the end. They wanted me to choreograph skating. So I ended up having double for Robin. So all the shots were me long and my feet. Robin didn't know how to skate at all. So they put him on javelin shoes.
So you're out there with him?
Oh no, I work with him for like, couple weeks.
Cool.
Yeah. Unbelievable, man. Like, my heart aches that he's not with us because he was such a gift. Like, I've blown away. He, I'll tell some stories, but we're doing some stuff on the ice and I had to choreograph and I'm showing him all the choreography, upper body, and then they'd shoot my legs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they tried to get him to do a Russian split. So what they did was they couldn't, obviously can't do one. So a Russian split is basically touching your feet in the air like this. So I would do the Russian split. I'd get up in the air. And to get him, they'd put him in some skates.
Yeah.
And then they put him on a trampoline on the ice, and then he'd bounce, and then he would try to get his legs up, and he would, he'd get the, and then, so they at least they'd get the air shot like it was him.
Then they'd cut to you.
Yeah, and then they cut, like, so they cut to me on my legs taking off, and then they catch him going, like, that. It was hysterical.
So it probably looked a little goofy in the movie.
Yeah, but it was so much fun, and he, I love the process. Like, there's the hurry up and wait, which is a pain.
Totally, yeah.
But it was amazing. There was all these kids there, and like, it was such a long wait in between takes and things. And he would do stand up for the kids to keep them entertained. Like, in between shots, he'd go and do stand up and do stuff and with the kids. And he was amazing. He was unbelievable. And I remember I was trying to train because it was in the summer of 2001, and I was competing. I was getting ready for the 2002 Olympic season. It was going to be my last season, and it was pretty big. So I said, during lunch, I said, hey, can I use the ice surface to train? And they're like, yeah. So the producers, go ahead. So everyone's in craft eating. And I come out, and I start putting on my music, and I start doing my training session. And this was at Maple Leaf Gardens.
Cool.
Yeah, back then. And Robin was – he came out, and he's like, can I watch? And I'm like – of course, I'm just doing my, you know, training. So I'd get out there and I'd get in my zone and I'm doing my thing and I start training. And his face was lit up and he's like, he ran back and he took off and he came back. He brought like all the crew.
Yeah.
And like, you got to watch him. And I'm just like, can we watch? I'm like, yeah, it's okay. I'm just getting ready for Olympics next year. They're like, they didn't know because I didn't talk. I don't talk about it. I was just doing my thing. So I'm running through programs and doing stuff for like, I'm 45 minutes. I'm trying to cram in my training. And he was like ecstatic, and I'm like, dude, you're Robin Williams. Like, this is crazy, you know? And we talked about skating, and then I remember one day I was taking a break, and I was down on the other end of the rink by the big set, big Rainbow Randolph, and I was actually having some food, and he saw me, he walked all the way around the rink, he sat down, and we just started talking about, you know, life and skating and movies and stuff, and told him I said I'd love to do the acting one day when I'm done skating. And I always loved Star Wars. I grew up with Star Wars, loved to be in a Star Wars movie, play Han Solo. So I was bummed out when they had the Han Solo movie. I was like, I want to be Han Solo. But anyways, so we talked and stuff. And then at the very end of the last day of the shoot, we were rapping. He comes in and he has presents for all the crew and all the actors, everyone. And I got a stack of presents and I'm like, what is he got me all Star Wars stuff, all Star Wars paraphernalia. Everybody got something really cool. Like he went out of his way to like connect with everybody. And like, it was the most amazing experience to share. Like I was just blessed that I had time to spend with him and talk to him and stuff. He was an amazing, amazing man. And Edward Norton was super to himself. Didn't talk much. He was very quiet, very in his zone.
Yeah.
Where Robin loved being around. He had to be around people.
Totally. Yeah, you could see that from afar.
He just, it was amazing. And that whole experience just solidified for me why I love the acting part of it. Because in my skating, I had to block emotion away in a lot of to get the job done in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you want to have emotional content, there's certain emotions that could kick in. Or things that, you know, would pop up and be like, I can't deal with this right now. I got to put this aside and use another emotion to counter it. And you compartmentalize things. But in the acting, you can access this.
Mm.
So I'm like, this is awesome. So all of this stuff came about and I started doing more stuff. I played Billy Flynn on the show Chicago and New York and Toronto. And then did Ice Girls for, I don't know if it's on Netflix or on one of the other channels, but I've done a bunch of different things, Hudson and Rex and Murdoch Mysteries and then LB Acting. Lewis Bowmander invited me to become a teacher with him with a class based on my whole philosophy and energy and physicality of how to bring that to acting because I picked it up really fast and I'm just applying. And again, I just tell people, like, Kung Fu the shit out of everything.
It's just
Kung Fu, right? So it's just the way I look at things. But that's basically how my acting thing, where it started and kind of a couple cool stories along the way. Yeah.
You seem to enjoy a lot of different endeavors. You've probably had certain chapters to your life. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's struggling to find what they want to do with their life or their purpose?
Yeah, it's a really, that one is, it's the real reason why we're here is trying to find that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Is not let anyone dictate what you should be doing. This is, that's where you go out and just try things you think you want to try.
Mm-hmm.
Try everything. Mm-hmm. Fall on your face, make mistakes until you figure it out.
Yeah.
That's the best way. Nothing's going to be perfect. Allow things to be messy.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, I learned that through acting too. It's like certain scenes, like doing auditions, you go into an audition and you're like, oh, I nailed it. And you get the part. You go in and you're like, oh my God, that was the worst thing ever. And it was really messy. And you get the part. Really, it ends up being from the fact that in life, things are messy and it's not always perfect. The way you think your mind thinks is going to be perfect because you line it all up, the perfect life. We like to control things to make ourselves feel comfortable.
Yep.
But in order to move forward, you got to learn how to be comfortable being uncomfortable in order to move forward, to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So with that being said, it's make the mistakes, go for it, and don't listen to what other people think you should be doing. Right? Take advice, listen to what's around, and make your choice accordingly on what your heart tells you. Not what logically looks good on paper, but what you feel. And try to, I would go back to the inner child, is listen to the inner child.
Mm.
What would my 5-year-old self want to do? Because that's usually the non, I guess, social tainted choice.
Yeah, you're not, you haven't really come in contact with much culture yet.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like going back to that untainted part of yourself where you're just, that's joy.
Mm.
You know, doing like the joy of ripping around in a go-kart or going on a track or skating and just, there's no winning. There's just excitement of getting better and understanding and seeing how your body works in this situation and experiencing.
Mm.
The life of experiencing. So it's just being able to make it that simple and not think about the money involved, the image I'm going to have, who I'm going to impress, what other people will think if I choose this really cool job because everyone thinks that's all surface crap.
Right.
Got to find the heart. What makes you tick? Again, Neo, know yourself.
So what does success look like to you on a whole, you know, as far as personal life, competition, sport?
Oh, man. I feel like my life, I went through so much in skating, finding the love of my life in Mexico. She's unbelievable. Like when I found self-love, I met her a month later, and we got married a year later, and boom, that was it. Like, it was just there. I knew right away. And again, I had that vision. I was like, I told my best friend, I was like, when I'm ready, she's going to walk through the door, and I'm going to know. And she walked in the rink in Mexico, and I looked over there, and I'm like,
there she
That's
is.
That's my wife. Wow. Found out who she was, and a year later, we were married.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw it happen exactly the way I saw it in my head. And it's, you know, success really is the is finding true happiness. That's success. You know, that bliss that you feel, you know, that you raced and you're in that zone, you're just like, this is bliss. This is awesome. That's telling you that's where you're supposed to be. Like, this is where you live. This is where you get energized. Again, my wife's my best friend. We spend so much time together. We've been together for 14 years, and like, I was away on the weekend and we miss each other. Like, it's just that energy. Career wise, is just living this dream of for me, I like competing at the highest level. I want to get as high as the highest level I can get in racing. Grassroots is great. It's but I want to challenge myself. That's how I'm built.
Yeah.
So maybe I want to IMSA, LMP2, running WEC, whatever. Like, just think big.
Yeah. You know, yeah, in your wildest dreams.
Wildest dream, and just dare to dream it, and then see what happens. Right. And that to me, and you know, got to put in the work and understanding, and you got to go through what everyone else goes through. And it, but that to me is, and I look at it as the excitement. So it's not just the, because once you get to the end, you're like, yeah, awesome. But then you're like, what's left?
Yeah.
Right. What's the next mountain?
Yeah.
So skating was one mountain. Acting is another mountain. I'm climbing one. And then the racing is this other mountain. And along the way, I discovered really cool things, have great stories, share with people to help them on their journey, and share some cool moments, and just live life the way my inner child wants to live it, and be happy. Be happy with me to know that I'm complete, that I don't need to win to be complete. Just let me experience this, because I want to experience this road, and I want to be in a car doing it at like a bazillion miles an hour.
Man. That's a good place to end it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on, taking the time.
Oh, Gary, no, this is awesome. Thank you. This is, to be able to have the time to sit down and have like an in-depth conversation.
Yeah.
And share some cool stuff. And you got some great questions, because it pulled a lot of stuff out of me. I get animated and stuff when I talk.
That's perfect.
I go on a tangent sometimes, and people can't shut me up. But
that's good. Tell the people where they can find you, follow you on social and stuff.
Yeah, I just have Instagram. So it's Elvis Toyko, because it doesn't have two S's, Elvis Toyko, but you'll be able to see it. And that's where people can find me. That's my main handle. And yeah, all my stuff for skating is there. All my racing stuff is there. Just trying to pull, again, last minute, trying to get sponsorship.
Yeah.
Trying to get ready for hopefully race with Tooth. I'm so excited to be able to be a part of that. Do some testing if I don't race, if I don't have the money coming in, but we'll see what the universe holds for me. And yeah.
Cool. See you at the track.
Done deal.
Right on. If you guys enjoyed this podcast, tickle the algorithm, give it a like, share it with some friends. Appreciate you guys.